Tiwari. Welcome to another episode of the Brain Podcast. And today I'm excited to talk about, number one, Alzheimer's disease prevention and why prevention is exciting to me, and what are the different ways in which we are looking at prevention. So using a multimodal approach to prevention of Alzheimer's. And Alzheimer's is one of the numerous dementias that are there, but it's the commonest one. And more importantly, today I'm very excited to have a co-host with me. So Andy is with me here today. And before I introduce myself, Andy, I would love our audience to get to know about you. So over to you.
Well, I am so excited to be doing this podcast with you today, Dr. Shabnam. And we've known each other as Tiny Habits Coaches. I'm a behavior design consultant for organizations that want to do good things in the world. I basically work with organizations to teach them a science-based system for behavior change, where it makes things easy so they can design better products, better services, do better things for their employees, and improve the overall health and wellness of individuals and the world. And I am a real aficionado, I'll say, of your work and of brain health. So I'm really excited to be co-hosting with you. And I want to just give our listeners a lay of the land here that we will be talking about a specific approach to Alzheimer's. First, we're going to talk about why Alzheimer's prevention is so important. And then we're going to talk about the FINGERS approach, which is a multimodal approach that's really groundbreaking and it's well-researched. So we'll tell you what it is and we'll go a little deeper into what that means. And then we are going to share with you practical ways you can apply this approach in your life right now to get the most out of it and to improve your brain health.
Thank you, Andy. So I am Dr. Shabnam Daskar. I'm a functional medicine doctor. I live in Alberta in Canada, and I am a clinician, educator, a brain health advocate, and I am a health tech enthusiast. And the reason I'm interested in the brain is because, as I always say, I have one and I intend to keep it.
So, I'm adopting that.
Thank you. So why is the problem of dementia so big? Now, all of you know, I'm sure each one of you listening to this podcast, you either know someone who has dementia or you have someone in your family, a loved one, maybe you are taking care of them. And you know that there isn't any specific treatment for dementias like Alzheimer's. And the reason is, there are many different reasons. The reason Andrea and I are excited about this particular, the FINGER trial, about which we'll talk about, is it looks at multiple domains. So it looks at many different areas. Now, over the last several years, many billions of dollars have been spent in researching and trying to find some treatment for Alzheimer's. Unfortunately, until today, there is no specific treatment available for Alzheimer's. Now, I have to qualify that statement. There are some medications for symptom management, but there is nothing that is going to actually cure Alzheimer's today.
And I think if for our listeners too, that is one reason why prevention is so important. And if it's, whether it's you or someone you love, we all want to prevent our loved ones from what we've seen happening with Alzheimer's. And what you've shared too is that there's just a little bit of treatment for symptoms and really no cure yet.
Thank you, Andrea. So the reason prevention is so important and the reason we are excited about the FINGERS project is Alzheimer's actually starts many years before someone develops the symptoms. So usually, most medical studies have shown that it starts 20 to 30 years before someone develops symptoms. And as a functional medicine doctor, I'm always looking at predictive preventive medicine. So I'm always looking at, are there any kind of clues? Are there any red flags earlier on in someone's life, which can tell us that, okay, if I can deal with that or help someone make some changes in their lifestyle, can it help them over the long term to avoid dementia? And the other important thing is brain health and heart health are intimately related. So with all the numerous Alzheimer's trials, most of them, like it happens in medicine, they were mostly looking at single targets. So they would target the amyloid plaques or the tau protein. But Alzheimer's is a very, very complex disease, and it's not the same for everyone. So there are many, many different factors which impact whether someone is going to get Alzheimer's or not. And that actually is, in a way, it is interesting in the sense that this is what I believe in. And there are some studies, lots of studies showing that, that if you can make small changes over a period of time, the end result in terms of, you know, maintaining brain health and preventing dementia, preventing early heart disease and stroke and all of those, it goes a long way. So it's not like one big boom, something, this is the only thing you need to do and it'll be fine. But small changes, things like, you know, maybe increasing your daily step by just 1,000 steps. Small incremental changes are something I believe in a lot. So why the finger trial? So what is the finger trial, number one? And number two is why this is exciting is because it is looking at multi-domain. So that means I'm going to read out the name of the paper. And Andrea, I mean, always these medical articles, they have such a long name and they have—
It's a huge name. It's a huge name. And before you read out that name for the listeners, let's talk about what is a multimodal approach.
Okay, sorry. Thank you, Andy, for reminding me.
Yeah, so really, a lot of us who are kind of nerdy about this stuff, we totally get that. But this is something, first of all, let's explain what a multimodal approach is, and then explain why it's so groundbreaking.
Thank you. So let us say that there are 20 different paths to someone developing Alzheimer's down the line. When we talk about multimodal, what it means is instead of addressing just one pathway, maybe instead of addressing only hypertension, where having uncontrolled blood pressure is one of the risk factors for cognitive decline, these multimodal approaches are looking at multiple areas. So they are also looking at managing blood pressure better. They're looking at managing diabetes better. They are looking at cognitive function and cognitive exercise training. Then they are also looking at food. Food has such a huge impact. So Andrew, actually on food alone, I think we can do an entire series.
I think you are right. So yeah. For clarifying, what typically happens is they might say, oh, let's scientists, let's clarify who we're talking about here. Scientists or researchers might say, we see a link between uncontrolled blood pressure and Alzheimer's. Let's do something about the blood pressure. Or they might say, or even physicians who recognize that link might address the blood pressure. And they might also see separately and individually, not in the same person, or maybe both, but they would be addressing the diabetes as also a way to do that. They are addressing these all, but in isolation. Whereas this fingers trial, and then they rarely include food in that.
Yeah.
Rarely do physicians say, you know, eat this, it's good for your brain. So what I'm understanding, and I want to clarify for the listeners here, is that this typical approach is very isolated. And this fingers approach out of Finland looked at managing all of those bits and what happened when they managed them in concert with one another. Did I get that right?
Thank you, Andy. You clarified so well. Thank you so much. So going back to the finger now, the first trial was in Finland in 2015, and it was published in a very prestigious journal called The Lancet. So the name of this particular study is a 2-year multi-domain intervention of diet, exercise, cognitive training, and vascular risk monitoring versus control to prevent cognitive decline in at-risk elderly people, a randomized control trial. And the acronym for that is FINGER. So from that 2015 study, which was for 2 years, then they decided to continue it for longer. Now they have actually come up with a worldwide fingers. So they are doing similar trials in many countries in the world, including Asian countries and South American countries. So there is a finger in the US. It's called US Pointer. There is one in Canada as well. There is one in India. They have already done an early trial in Singapore, which they called Singer. And they have also done one in Korea. And it is really interesting because these trials are at a public health level. So just to clarify, what is a public health level versus my area of expertise is not in public health. I am someone who is used to treating patients or clients one-on-one or in groups, but not like in terms of policy. And even actually the World Health Organization has declared that dementia prevention is what we need to focus on. For years and years, it was treatment, you know, cure for Alzheimer's. And now for the first time in the last several years after the finger trial, the conversation has changed to let us look at what we can do in terms of prevention, but not necessarily from just like a one-on-one perspective, but what can we do from a larger, you know, healthcare system, public health kind of a thing. So that is very, very exciting because it's like, as we know, and maybe I'm going to post the graph on the in the show notes, dementias like Alzheimer's are becoming like, it's like, again, because of diabetes is again like an epidemic. In the years to come, Alzheimer's and similar dementias are going to be a very big problem worldwide. And Andy, the unfortunate thing is because I was a physician in India and I know how the healthcare system works there. Most healthcare systems in resource poor countries are not geared to deal with so many people with, you know, dementia. Because you know that, you know, how much care a person with dementia needs. And it is usually the family members who are left to care for them. And this major increase in dementia worldwide is going to be more in the low and the medium income countries, not so much in countries like the US and Canada where it's already high. So these countries are not going to have more people, but those countries with lesser resources are going to have a much bigger problem. So in the next, you know, maybe 10, 20 years, this is a very, very big problem. So that is the reason if we don't start dealing with it right now from the preventive perspective, we are really going, I really don't know. I mean, I shudder to think what is going to happen.
And I think you're very right in the sense that explaining that this study is not only something, this is not only something that a person, an individual can implement some of these strategies for themselves or for their loved ones, with their loved ones, I would say, right away. But what's really groundbreaking about this approach is that it does hit at a public policy level, which means that's the level where change can be made that can support everyone. And when we have research like this, government institutions and worldwide institutions are more likely to get behind it and place policies and supports in place to help the global population as a whole. And the other thing I hear you saying is, if anybody has anyone with Alzheimer's and dementia in their life, they know how challenging it is for them and their loved ones. But also when you magnify that out of the family level into the worldwide level, the supports simply aren't there. And so prevention of Alzheimer's on a grander scale is what's really required if we're, as a society, going to move forward and use our resources for the greatest good.
Thank you, Andy. So what did they do in this trial? So this was done in six different centers in Finland. So the people who were part of this study were in the age group of 60 to 77 years. Now, from the perspective of preventive medicine, I would think that 60 is a little late to start, but any time is good enough. So if they had maybe...
So I want to pause you right there because I'm sure there are a lot of listeners who say, wait a minute, I'm, you know, only 35 or 40. Do I really need to be thinking about this right now? And I'm sure that we have people who are, you know, 50 and 60 and are thinking, man, am I doomed? So let's take a moment and answer the question. If you're in your 30s or 40s, how will we weave that in? Like, how will we support them? does this fingers approach work for them? And if you're already in your 60s, can you help yourself, or are you kind of on a path that you can't change? And then we'll go into the other bit. But I want to just put the listeners at ease here that we know that there's support out there, but I think they need to hear it from you.
Thank you, Andy. So what is the best time to start working on prevention of cognitive decline? It is now. So whether you are 25-year-old or you're 30-year-old or you're 50-year-old or 60 or 70, at any point in your life, if you decide to make changes, it is going to have a huge impact on your long-term health and on your immediate health as well. Because some of the things, like, you know, if you change your food, for example, and we'll talk about food as well, if you change your food from eating a lot of sugary and flour and processed food to eating real food, people have experienced changes in just maybe 24 to 48 hours. Like, right, Andy, you have, yes, you have yourself experienced a lot of that. And I know you know a lot of people. And I, as a clinician, my patients, first thing they'll say, my brain is, you know, functioning better. The brain fog is gone.
Yeah, so, I'm here for that.
So these strategies will help. And in fact, this is again very interesting, because nowadays people don't talk about, you know, prevention or treatment of Alzheimer's right at the last minute. They are talking about a whole life course. So anytime, in fact, I would actually, as a former OBGY, I would say the best time is to start before you get pregnant, because the mother's, you know, metabolic health, diabetes, hypertension, all these things have a huge impact on the child's health as an adult. So anytime is a good time, and it is never too late and it is never too early. So as one of
perfect. I think that's our quote. It's never too late and it's never too early to work on your brain health. So back to the fingers study, it was done with people in their 60s, 50s, 60s.
Yeah, 60 to 77.
60 to 77.
So who were the people who qualified for this trial? So they were checked for their cognitive performance. So their cognitive performance was at a level which was about the average for that age, or slightly lower than expected for that age. But they were not people who already had Alzheimer's or who already had even mild cognitive impairment. So mild cognitive impairment is supposed to be pre-Alzheimer's. So they were not that severely impaired. And that is important, because sometimes, you know, these multimodal lifestyle changes, and when you ask a person to do a lot of things, if they already have advanced cognitive decline, it becomes a challenge. And then, unfortunately, you know, loved ones, the family is like struggling. I want my father to do this, and he's just not motivated. And I have to tell people, you know, it's not his motivation. That's his condition that is making him like that. So just be a little kind on him and on you, because it's not that he willfully does not want to do something. You know, I have had these conversations, Andrea, with not so much with patients as with their relatives, with their, you know, husbands, wives, people like them. So the two-year intervention, what did it consist of? Exercise, cognitive training, social activity, and management of metabolic and vascular risk factors. So I'll just explain what is vascular and metabolic risk factors. Metabolic essentially would mean things like diabetes. We know that people with diabetes have a much higher risk for dementia, particularly if the diabetes is not well managed. And there are numerous reasons for diabetes not being well managed and not so. And Andy, this is the surprising factor which I discovered sort of recently when I was going into the research of why is diabetes and hypertension not as well managed. So sometimes it's not the patient who's at fault. It's also the doctor. So it's called clinician inertia. But anyway, that is not a part of the finger trial. So they decided that they are going to manage blood glucose levels in these participants really well, as well as vascular is mostly blood related to blood vessels. So hypertension. So hypertension, diabetes management was intensified in the sense that they were being monitored more often. And obviously, when someone is monitored more often, the chances are higher that it will be better managed. particularly for hypertension, because hypertension often does not have any symptoms. And another interesting observation, Andy, so I was looking at the Singapore trial, the Singer trial and the Finger trial. In Singapore, the incidence of hypertension, of course, this was a small group of people, this is just 70 people. It was about 87% of people had hypertension. And diabetes as well was about 26%. Versus in Finland, diabetes was, I think, around 13%. So conditions like diabetes and hypertension all over the world are very high. But in some countries in Asia, it can be extremely high.
So Interesting.
Yeah. So what did they do? Persons in the control group. So these were the ones who were not receiving the intervention in terms of the trial. They received regular health advice. So any clinical study, they have what is called a primary outcome and secondary outcome. So primary outcome was to look at cognitive performance. And there are a whole bunch of neuropsychological testing, like there are Stroop tests and trail making tests, and I'm not trained in that. So all I know is there are a lot of complicated testing, which is necessary. So this is, again, I'm digressing from the Finger trial a little bit. So Andy, the thing is with whenever we are looking at brain health, yes, there are some measurements of the body. So biometrics is what we call them, like your waist circumference, hip circumference, body fat percentage, not so much total weight, but how much of fat in which particular area. So belly fat is much more metabolically harmful than fat in maybe your, for women, bad arms. You know, the subcutaneous.
Oh, yes. Is that bad?
That is not as bad as the belly fat. So.
Okay, that's good to know. I think there's a whole host of women sighing relief right now.
Thank you. So that is one, what that is called biometrics. But in the ideal world, we would really like to do a neuropsychiatric assessment as well as brain imaging. Now, in the Finger trial, they did not do brain imaging because brain imaging is very expensive. So it's like doing a PET scan or an MRI scan or SPECT scan. So all those, any kind of scan, number one, the devices are very expensive and it's not cheap to get it done.
Right.
So we are looking at maybe in the years to come, we'll have easier tests which can check for cognition, but does not need a neuropsychiatric assessment and brain imaging. If we could overcome that, obviously we can look at, you know, checking cognitive function in a lot more people, younger people, and probably much easier if it's something like a phone app. You know, practically everyone has a smartphone nowadays. So the neuropsychiatric assessment is, again, like I said, in resource poor countries, it would be quite a challenge. But other good thing is nowadays, a lot of this you can also do online. But I think in the Singapore trial, they actually used pen and paper. So as you know, whenever you use pen and paper, the person has to visit the place. You have to have a trained person to actually provide, to give that test to the person. So this requires a lot of resources, and resources, I can only see dollar signs. You
know? Yes, resources means money, and it requires a lot of money. And if you're an individual, it requires a lot of your time. It's hard to do.
And money as well.
Yes.
Yeah, so this was the primary outcome was cognitive function, and secondary outcomes, that means what else did they look at, was the incidence of dementia after extended follow-up, because in 2 years, dementia may not show up, disability, depressive symptoms, vascular risk factors, quality of life, and how much of healthcare services did they use. And down the line, they are also planning to do neuroimaging. But I guess neuroimaging will also depend on the healthcare system. And as far as I know, Finland is similar to Canada. They have healthcare covered. So it could be that in countries which do not have all those resources, it may be a little different. But at the same time, I am very hopeful, Andy, that very soon we are going to have easier ways of measuring cognition, which does not involve a lot of neuropsychiatric testing or expensive brain imaging.
I am optimistic for that as well. And then we will get the feedback, you know, the world will get the feedback they need to make some better decisions on what to do with, you know, more information more quickly. better information more quickly, I would
say. And more often, because obviously you can't do a brain imaging every, you know, 6 months. It would usually be maybe a year. That would be like being optimistic. Anyway, in the interest of time, I'm going to rush a little bit now. Next thing they were looking at in the finger trial is food. So here, Andy, as you know, I have certain, you know, I have some comments on the food.
We should just hop right on the food podcast, because then everyone after they listen to this can, I feel like every single podcast we're going to do together, we're going to reference food. So we may as well do one whole podcast on food. So if you're listening right now, go look for it. It will be clear. We'll probably pop it up at the site and have a really good, deep, long discussion on food and brain health.
Thank you. Yeah, it does sound like it's going to be more than one episode, likely.
Agree.
So I'm going to just talk about the finger trial food recommendation. So this was the nutritional intervention was based on the Finnish nutrition recommendation, and it was conducted by study nutritionists. Now, one thing I want to highlight here is they had 3 individual sessions and 7 to 9 group sessions. So each person went through at least 12 sessions. And as someone who is in the pay for services world, Andy, I'm thinking, if someone pays me, of course I'm going to do that. I can help people, no doubt.
Exactly.
But if you are paying from your pocket, can you imagine 12 nutrition sessions? So this was a very intensive intervention. Then, of course, individual sessions included tailoring of the participants' diet and group sessions. But the food recommendations, I have a few things to talk about that, and we will dive deep into these in another episode. So what were they advised to use? So participants were advised to consume a diet with 10 to 20% of daily energy coming from proteins and 25 to 30% coming from fat. So in the 25 to 30% coming from fat, less than 10% should come from saturated plus trans fats. Here is where I have some comments really, because number one is, how can you club saturated fat plus artificial trans fats together? So they did not qualify artificial or natural. Now, artificial trans fats are those which come from hydrogenated vegetable oils. A lot of them are present in store-bought food like cakes and cookies and pastries and stuff like that. There is a small amount of trans fat even in natural food like some meats. But number one, how can you club, you know, food like natural meat as Mother Nature made them with trans fats? And trans fats, so, and in the world of all the different types of fat and the confusion and all the debate that goes on, if there is one part of it that everyone agrees on, is the harmful effects of artificial trans fats. Like, there is no debate over that.
And that's really comforting to know that at least there's one thing in the world that the scientists can agree on, is artificial trans fats bad.
You know, gets a lot of bad reputation. And despite a lot of studies showing that saturated fat is not the trouble, a lot of people, including my doctor colleagues and maybe nutritionists as well, are still in the saturated fat is going to kill you world. And sometimes I have to tell them, I said, y'all don't read enough, you know. Anyway, going back to my pet peeve of, you know, how can you club fat from good quality food like, you know, sustainably raised meat with artificial trans fats? So there is no doubt in anyone's mind about the harmful effects of trans fats. In fact, worldwide, there is a huge, you know, movement going on to reduce trans fat levels to zero. So I think Denmark was the first country to do that. So in food packaging, it has to be zero. Canada started it as well. And so zero trans fat is what we are aiming for. So if you tell somebody, you know, your total trans fat plus saturated fat should be 10%, what prevents them from thinking that I'm going to eat 8% of trans fat and 2% of saturated fat? So
Exactly. You know, and here's where specificity really changes behavior.
Absolutely.
Okay? It's not just simplicity, but it's specificity, because people need to understand exactly what they need to do in order to be healthy, or in order to prevent Alzheimer's, or in order to have better brain health. And that is definitely not a specific behavior that we're asking people to do. And it's not clear from the community that it's not just you can't really do that with trans fats. So that's a really great point.
Mm-hmm. And of course, I'm sure because they were meeting nutritionists for 12 sessions over 2 years. So I'm sure the nutritionists actually pointed out what was healthy and what was not. The other thing is omega-3 fatty acids, they have included 2.5 to 3 grams per day of omega-3s. And the good thing is that is definitely omega-3 fatty acids are necessary for the brain. Again, you know, Andy, while talking about this, I feel, oh, we need one entire episode on omega-3s.
Yeah.
But the point is, are you going to get 2.5 to 3 grams of omega-3 from only food without supplementation? So we are going to have an episode on that. And the simple answer is no. Even if you eat fatty fish every day, and most people talk about omega-3s from fish like wild salmon, whereas lamb and some other meat contain a lot of omega-3s as well. And in Health Canada actually recommends that we should not eat more than 2 servings of fish in a week. Now, 2 servings of fish in a week are not going to give us 2.5 to 3 grams per day of omega. In the ideal world, if you are listening to this, what I would suggest is, number one, you need to know what your levels of omega-3 in the blood are. There are some specialized testings available. Those tests are available actually in many countries, including US and Canada. So the best is to know what your levels are so that you know how you can, you know, and obviously you're going to need a combination of food as well as supplements. Relying only on food is very likely not going to give you enough omega-3s. One more comment on omega-3s is, having high triglycerides, so that is one of the bad fats in your lipid panel, very high levels of triglycerides are extremely harmful for brain and the heart. And omega-3 fatty acids as a prescription product is available at 4 grams a day. So that has shown benefits. So we are going to talk about omega-3 another day. Next, this is where my other pet peeve comes, 45 to 50% of daily energy from carbohydrates. And less than 10% from refined sugar. So,
and let's just define what they mean by carbohydrate there. There's a lot of carb counters out there. So let's be clear what we mean. We know what we mean, but let's be clear for our listeners.
Yeah, thank you, Andy. So carbohydrates are food that are either themselves, they are sugar or they make sugar. So carbohydrates essentially are your rice, pasta, bread, pizzas. Then for a lot of South Asian people, it's the rotis, the things made from grains. And what else did I miss out, Andy?
Ultimately fruit, right?
Fruit, yes. Fruit is actually a different category, not so much in this category of carbohydrates. Yes, but they do contain carbohydrates as well, particularly some of the high sugar fruits like mangoes and banana has a lot of sugar as well. So in simple words, even if it is not sweet, this is a confusion sometimes people have where, okay, sugar is bad. Everyone knows about it. So less than 10% from refined sugar, but a whole wheat brown bread can, you know, make a lot of sugar as well. So sometimes a whole wheat, which is supposed to be healthy, well, you just need to check your blood glucose levels after 1 hour after eating a whole wheat toast. For many people, it raises their blood glucose levels to beyond someone who has diabetes. And this is in people who don't have diabetes. So
that's what is important for people to understand is that sweets are carbohydrates, but even things that are savory, like your rotis and your whole wheat bread and things like that, those can turn into sugar and have the same effect and sometimes even more.
Yes. So some of these can raise blood glucose levels way higher than just even sugar. And that is something which is a surprise to a lot of people, Andy, because I don't eat any sugar. I don't like sweets. But, you know, you're eating a lot of bread. You know.
Yeah, crusty bread can do the same thing to you.
Yeah. And the other good thing is they had, so I'm going back to the finger trial in the food, 25 to 35 grams per day of dietary fiber. That is good. And less than 5 grams per day of salt. And interestingly, I like it that they said less than 5 grams and not less than 1500 grams, because some recent studies have shown that going like super, super low in sodium. So salt, the table salt contains sodium, it's sodium chloride, but the sodium component of it is supposed to raise blood pressure in a lot of people. And, you know, so very high sodium intake is related to a lot of harmful stuff. But how low should we go? So recently there was a lot of conversation about you need to go lower than 1500. Recently, this was, I think, just a week or 2 weeks ago, a paper came out from Canada where going down super low did not really help people. And these were people with heart failure. So those are very seriously ill people. So the good thing is they didn't say you have to go down to below 1500 milligrams. This was just less than 5 grams a day of salt. And another interesting thing is less than 5% daily energy from alcohol. So again, each one of these, I think, Andy, we're going to need an episode.
we're tallying the episode here. We're creating the whole series.
So another important thing is they were looking at 5 to 10% of reduction in body weight if these people were overweight, and depending on their health status, age, and all those things. Now, in medical terms, 5 to 10% reduction of body weight is considered to be significant weight loss. And 5 to 10% is like if someone weighs, let us say, you know, 150 pounds, 10% is just 15 pounds. So someone might feel, oh, that's like, what is there? I haven't reached my normal body weight. I am not losing the weight I want to. But even that relatively small weight loss can have a huge impact on your long-term health. So I want to give a message of hope, because I know a lot of, and I'm one of them, who are constantly worried about, you know, weight loss and, you know, why am I not losing weight? And if I lose it, why am I not keeping it away? But the point is you don't have to reach even the level where you want to be. So most people I meet, Andy, they want to be at a much lower body weight than even, you know, required by health. So
the takeaway here is that really even just 10%. So even if you're not exactly going to, that 10% is not going to get you at your personal ideal body weight, you still can improve your health and well-being simply by going down about 10%, which is probably much more manageable, and people are going to feel much more successful. And that will probably lead to a little more success, right? We often feel unsuccessful because maybe you don't get to your goal weight, but knowing that just 10% of a change in your weight can improve is really hopeful. What a great message of hope.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that is what I want to, you know, stress upon, that just because you've not achieved what you said, you know, your personal desired weight, it doesn't mean it's useless and hopeless. Any amount of weight loss is great. And the next part of the food recommendations in the finger trial was, of course, consumption of whole grain cereal. I've already talked about that and how it raises blood glucose levels. And this was the shocking part, you know, which I do hope it does change over the over a period of time. They recommended the use of vegetable margarine and rapeseed oil instead of butter. I don't know where that came from, because vegetable margarine is not, and rapeseed oil, all these industrial seed oils are very inflammatory, not good for the brain at all compared to things like butter or ghee or, you know, olive oil or coconut oil. And again, a lot of the problems is in the processing. So that is the oil episode, Andy.
Right.
So next comes exercise. So again, exercise, they had physiotherapists at the gym. And so again, I'm thinking of, you know, resources and dollar signs in front of my eyes.
Yeah, it's big dollar signs on this. Yeah.
that consisted of individually tailored programs for progressive muscle strength training, which is extremely important for maintaining optimal blood glucose levels and brain fitness. So 1 to 3 times per week, and aerobic exercise 2 to 5 times a week. So including exercises to improve posture balance and strength training and all those things. The point here I'm trying to make is someone who's between the age of 60 and 77 would probably, I would assume many of them would be retired and have the time to go through such an intensive process. Versus if we were going to look at the same interventions in someone who's younger and has a regular life, going to work, taking care of kids, doing all those things, we will definitely have to find ways on how it can be made easier for them to do all those without, maybe for many of these people, going to a gym for an exercise and meeting other people of similar age was something really exciting and wonderful, because they were probably retired, versus, you know, someone who's got a busy life, that is not going to be easy. And the same goes for cognitive training. So these were like 6 sessions of cognitive training, which included group and individual sessions. So bottom line is they included 3 times per week of cognitive sessions, each of 10 to 15 minutes. And I am not sure whether all they had to go to the center for all of these, or they could also do them online from home. But at the same time, you know, Andy, you know, and I know that very well, to create a habit around doing a cognitive training as frequently, you know, 3 times per week, we need to have a system. And as you talked about, you know, behavior design and the tiny habits method, I think this is where we could do with a lot of help from the tiny habits method and behavior design. Because it's not lack of motivation or lack of this, or you need extreme willpower, but you need to create it in such a way that it is easy to do. So that is something yes. we'll talk about later.
Exactly. On. And I think what this is illuminating is that there are a lot of moving pieces to this. And if you're someone that has a lot of time and motivation to do this, then and money, right? So you have time, money, and motivation, then you're going to be able to do this. But the trick is going to be to translate that to what it looks like for everybody else, whether they're a working mom, whether they're a stay-at-home parent, whether they're, you know, a CEO or whatever line of work they are in, or if they're in more developing countries, to translate this to something that's more workable and to help people form the habits that they want to do that will help them move forward. Those are all the pieces that we are trying to help you work on today by, first of all, informing you on what's going on. And then in a little bit, we'll talk about maybe some tiny habits where people can actually start implementing some of these things right away.
Yeah, thank you. So one thing which is really interesting, what they found is participation in this 2-year-long trial was very high. It was like 72% in all the 4 intervention domains. And that is actually a really fantastic result, because quite often what happens, particularly when these are longer trials, that people get fatigued. So I am sure these, you know, all these teams were doing something so wonderful that people wanted to go there and take part in all these things. And obviously they were feeling good, I'm sure. So Andy, I tried to look for any, you know, videos of anyone who had participated in the trial talking about their experience. I didn't find. So most of them.
That would be very interesting, actually.
Yeah, I just wanted to know, how did they feel? Like a 77-year-old man or a woman who was compliant with this trial, and how did they feel and what made them feel hopeful and good? So anyway, I don't have that information, but these stories are what really excite us, right? But 72% participation is really fantastic. So really great, great job to them. I mean, hats off to the team. So what did they find from this trial, which is again, very, very, very hopeful message. What they found is this multi-domain intervention suggests that it is possible to improve or maintain cognitive functioning in at-risk elderly people from the general population. So in the 2 years of study, the people who were in the intervention, so those who received all these intensive intervention, they, number one, did not deteriorate in their cognitive function the way the control group did. So the control group just got regular health care. They did not, they were not subjected to such intense intervention. And moreover, these studies are going to go on long term. So I am sure they're going to find great benefits over the long term. But as a, you know, as a certified Tiny Habits coach, and I'm sure, and Andy, you as a behavior design and a specialist and a Tiny Habits coach, the most important question I would love to answer, I would love to know, is how long did they succeed in maintaining all of those?
It's true. It's true. Because what's interesting is they had a lot of support in doing all those things. And so I don't think they got, because it's not, this is not typical. Behavior design is a relatively new field. It's not typical that they would get support in forming the habits and setting up their environment that would support their success. Now, I might guess that if people did feel successful and could change, could feel the difference, that they might still, and especially over 2 years, that they might have set up their environment to support their success. But I would be very, very curious to know how, what happened with them.
I know. And I'm sure someone or the other is going to tell us, because this is such a, you know, really wonderful trial. And it's really groundbreaking, as you said at the beginning. So Andy, I know you are so much better than me at, you know, summarizing everything we talked about and what it would mean for an individual. So I'll let you do that.
Perfect. So really what we discussed today is why Alzheimer's prevention is so important. And that's largely because there are really only a few treatments, and the treatments are really only for symptoms, and they don't work very well. So prevention is really the path toward the quote unquote cure, because we don't, our technology really is not at the point, or medicine is just really not at the point where they are going to cure Alzheimer's anytime soon. And we also talked about how it's really important to start today, that it's never too early and it's never too late to start working on your brain health and Alzheimer's prevention. So wherever you are, you're good. Then we really discussed the fingers trial medical, which is a multimodal approach, which means they looked at a variety of different risk factors. And instead of addressing them individually, they addressed them as a collective, and not just with medication. They addressed them with lifestyle changes. And then they tracked them very, very frequently and regularly so they could see what was working. And then we really discussed some of the chinks in that study, especially relating around food. However, the overall, the study is very, very hopeful, showing that this multimodal approach with things that everybody can do, everybody can change their food, everybody can do a little more exercise, all and all of those things help to manage and prevent Alzheimer's, to make it really, really hopeful in preventing Alzheimer's starting now for you. And maybe we want to talk about a few maybe tiny habit recipes that people could try. I would just say around exercise, one of the things is, one of a great tiny habit recipe would be, after I start the coffee maker or pour my tea, I will do 2 squats.
Yeah, that is awesome. And then how do you suggest they celebrate? Because that's such an important part of the Tiny Habits method.
Oh, that is, what a great catch on that one. I would say, I'm going to celebrate with an identity statement by saying, I'm the type of person that takes care of my health.
Wow, that is great.
And we could even do something around food. After I go, after I walk into the market or farmer's market or grocery store, I will turn toward the fresh produce section.
Yes.
And celebrate by saying, way to go, in my head or out loud, if you're that type of person.
Yeah, that's really awesome. So 2 great recipes, Andy. Thank you so much. So we will meet in the next episode. And thank you very much. Thank you, Andy. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Cheers, everyone.